feet for. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's on 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting in Canada, he's fighting in France, he's fighting in the USA. This way, and he's fighting for democracy or fighting for the red. He says it for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, in a war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from him and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end.
Tonight, we welcome to the New American Dream radio show for the first time John Grant, whose series of books on science denialism lead the reader to alternately laugh and cry while investigating the deliberate suppression of inconvenient truths. You know, on this show, we're all about bringing inconvenient truths to life. We're usually talking about political truths rather than scientific ones, but is there any real difference? Seems to me that truth is, well, truth. Mike wrote a book about that, about truth, a few years back. It was the first of his books I had the pleasure to read, as a matter of fact. I reviewed it for the Blue Ear community, long since defunct. I think that was somewhere around 2001, not long after that false flag attack on our own country. I was fascinated by the juxtaposition of quotes and oddball fiction on opposite pages throughout that book. I was hooked. My friendship with Mike started then, and it still goes on today with us co-hosting this show. That 9/11 attack that I referred to, that indirectly led to the end of another of my best friends. My good friend Tony had lost a friend in the Twin Tower collapse. And he became absolutely obsessed with discovering what really happened. When it first happened, he was ready to go off and kill an Arab or something because he thought that they were responsible. But the more he read about it, the more he looked into it, the more he realized it was an inside job. And he devoted the last 7 years of his life, I guess, to finding out what happened, and it just went off in 10 different directions. But Tony did everything in a big way. He was bigger than life, physically and mentally. It's all of that just finally caught up with him. His heart couldn't take it, and he died at 56. I still miss him every day. It's been 5 years now. back to who's on tonight. Our other guest, Abba Bird, was our very first guest on our very first show, February 3, 2011. Abba's poetry is eloquently disturbing, and we always look forward to listening to her. I'm looking forward to a great show tonight. Speaking of Abba Bird, I got my voter's registration card in the mail today. I thought I might have forgotten to change my address and anticipated having problems at the polls, or else, you know, actually considered not going. Now I'm all set, all signed up. And now it's really up to me whether I want to go ahead and vote. I mentioned Abba in that context because of a poem she wrote some time back. I'm going to read the beginning of it. I registered to vote, and all I got was jury duty in these endless wars. Propositions by prostitutes for votes for clowns, wolves in suits, pimps in pursuit of an old lady's loot and a young woman's womb. The full text of that poem is on our website, theshow.newamericandream.info. Search for Abba Bird. I don't really want to vote, but I think, well, that Romney guy might pull this thing off, and that scares me. I worry about the backsliding from women, the threat to Social Security. It'd be a slap in the face to African Americans, too, if the first black president got kicked out after one term. I'm sick to death over a lot of what Obama's done, but Romney looks even worse. Choosing between evils is not the way this democracy stuff is supposed to work. Figuring out which candidate is lying, well, that's easy. They both are! That's not supposed to be the way it is either. Our country started when the oppressed rose up and got rid of a tyrannical government. Now we just sit back and accept one that's probably worse than that one ever was. You think if it got bad enough, we might want to fight back. Maybe it'd be good if Romney got in, right? But, I'm not convinced there's enough people that care to ever make something like that happen again. They're in there, and they've got an awful lot of power already, and it's not going to be easy to do anything about it. But we can't let ourselves get depressed and give up. We need to find a better way. Here with a suggestion of what we can do is Bill Hicks.
It's just a ride, and we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever. In peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
I'm Chuck Gregory, and I thank you for joining us on the New American Dream radio show. And now I'm proud to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Pelichek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. How are you doing tonight? Tonight, as you mentioned, we welcome special guests Abba Bird, a Berkeley poet, and Scottish author John Grant. So tonight we are gathering together for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Berkeley, Duluth, wherever John Grant is, and wherever you are. websites, articles of particular note. I wanted to draw attention to Assassination Science by Professor Jim Fetzer. Google Assassination Science. Also, always Black Op Radio. Black Op is on Thursday nights. He comes on at, 8 o'clock, I think, Central Time. Anyway, Black Op Radio, Leno Sanic. And Kevin Barrett again on Veterans Today, a good article, 9/11 Perps, Still in the Saddle, Run Romney's Campaign, U.S. Courts and Media. And again, another one. This is the last one. Jim Fetzer on The Real Deal. That's Jim Fetzer's radio show. He has three interviews on the radio show of True Ott. The guy's name is T-R-U-E Ott. And they're real good interviews, a lot of good information there. Google Jim Fetzer, The Real Deal radio program. Okay, then I wanted to continue my series, something about why I think all the things I think about our country and government like conspiracies. And I was going through some of my history with jail. My last jail sentence was in 1989. It finished in 1989. It began in the fall of 1988. It was 6 months in the Council Bluffs, Iowa County Jail for trespass for crossing the line at Offutt Air Force Base. Offutt is the home of the Strategic Air Command, which at that time was responsible for the targeting of all the nuclear weapons in the United States military arsenal. When I was locked up those months and in previous jail sentences, I dealt with severe depression, and so I had to decide if I wanted to put myself and my family through that again. And it was a terrible decision to have to make. I thought I would just keep going to jail and prison forever. That was my career plan. Just keep fighting the United States and its military. And then I had to say that I couldn't do it, and then it was tough, and I still feel bad about it. I was released, as I said, that last time in the spring. I think it was May of 1989. It was the time of Tiananmen Square and the fall of the Berlin Wall, pretty close around that time anyway. Ruth and Sam and I, we left Greenfields Community in Omaha and moved to Norfolk, Nebraska. We rented an upstairs apartment. I went to work in construction for a while, and I remember it was one morning when I was knee-deep in concrete. I was a puddler on a concrete crew, and I remembered that I used to like to write. So I quit the construction job and went back to school at Wayne State College. It's about 30 miles from Norfolk. I took journalism classes, and I was still suffering from major clinical depression. I was trying to get off Xanax, and I had to run 10 miles in the morning and swim for an hour at noon just to get the energy to get through the day. And I got through the year, and instead of continuing the master's program I was in, I started to want to get started in a real journalism job. So I started applying, and I found a job as a reporter for the Ainsworth Star-Journal in western Nebraska, the Sand Hills. Well, you have to go there sometime to understand what it's like to live in western Nebraska. I'll just say that I had to increase my running program to keep from killing myself. But one thing I did like about the Sand Hills was the almost total lack of people. After being in jail, almost always after I got released from a jail term, I went through a period where I could not be around people. Any social activity was just too much for me. I almost could not function. And I think that the only reason you do function is because you have no choice. You could kill yourself when suffering from that sort of depression, but if you can't or won't do that, there just isn't much of a choice. The really bad part is that you can't do normal stuff. You know, I can't go in there. Why? Well, I just can't. And you feel bad about that. You don't understand it. You don't like it, and you feel bad about not being able to respond to people like you know you should. You just can't. So on top of feeling like shit, you feel guilty. Well, anyway, I was a reporter at the Ainsworth Star-Journal. I was the reporter. I did the news, the sports, layout, everything. And I had the nervous energy for it, that's for sure. Well, if you remember, the first Gulf War came about that time. Yellow ribbons, we support the troops, all that. It was everywhere, and especially it was in the Sand Hills. And as it happened, I had just convinced the editor, publisher to give me my own column. And as fate would have it, the first column came about the same time as we started to bomb everything in sight. So the headline on my first column was, "I do not support the troops." And the column was canceled. The publisher said he was not going to alienate his readership, his advertisers, and that just flew right in the face of everything that I thought journalism was supposed to be about. You know, you just do whatever you're supposed to do no matter what happens. Actually, that is the truth, but that's not what... anyway, my journalism bubble was burst. I still thought I could do it, do journalism the right way. So we moved from Ainsworth back to Norfolk and lived with my sister in her basement apartment for 6 months until we found a small newspaper we could afford to buy in southeastern Minnesota. That was the Byron Review. We eventually won the Minnesota Newspaper Association's Newspaper of the Year Award. That was 1994, and we went out of business the same year. But we had a lot of fun along the way. One thing I did learn, well, one story that I particularly liked when I worked on, the federal appeal trial of Leonard Peltier was in St. Paul. It was coming up, and I was fascinated with the case after having read Peter Matthiessen's In the Spirit of Crazy Horse. And local journal, you know, community journalism isn't supposed to be, you know, cover everything from border to border. You're supposed to just be concerned with the local. I can see that. But anyway, I wanted to cover this. So I assigned myself to interview Leonard Peltier in Leavenworth Penitentiary. I found a way to arrange that, and I also interviewed anyone I could find that had anything to do with the case. I called people on the phone. It was goons, you know, goons in the old, if you've seen the movie Braveheart, the goons are on there. And there's a goon in the movie who is a real goon, and he's one of the guys I interviewed. Somehow I found his name, and somehow I found his phone number. Anyway, one of those I interviewed was Nick O'Hare, the former head of the Omaha FBI. He was now the head of the Midwest FBI in Minneapolis, and he'd been a spokesman for the FBI in the Peltier case. So I drove to Leavenworth, Kansas from Byron, Minnesota, and I walked up those same steps I had walked up not that long ago as a prisoner, and I met with Peltier in the interview room, and I found him a sincere man. I then drove north from Byron. You know, after I got back, a few days later, drove from Byron to the Twin Cities to talk to Nick O'Hare in the Minneapolis FBI office, and I found him a lying, creepy sort of man, and that's just me. That's how I felt. I felt that Peltier was telling the truth and O'Hara was lying, and that's how I still feel. However, Peltier is still in federal prison, and O'Hara lives free in the Twin Cities, and I guess that's kind of how America works. Okay, that's enough. Next week I'll talk about seeing a cruise missile or some sort of guided missile, perhaps like the one that they guided into the Pentagon on 9/11 while I was on a walk on a dirt road by my wife's family's farm in southeastern South Dakota, and also maybe about the time I saw a UFO late at night while driving from Omaha to Norfolk, and maybe a walk, something about the walk from Norfolk to Offutt Air Force Base, from Sheldon, Iowa to Fort Dodge, and the walk from Sheldon, Iowa to Sioux City, all to see if the walking could have any effect on the United States military. Spoiler alert, not so much. Okay, now, back to you, Chuck.
Welcome, America, to the presidential debates of 2012. Your moderator will be a CIA agent who was planted in the journalism field decades ago and who will soon retire, thank you, Jesus. As you know, the two candidates are the red philodendron and the blue begonia. The crowd's being told by the TV director guy to please keep your applause till the end. Quiet. The hall is getting quiet. The moderator is waltzing in. Oh, wait. Something is happening in the really big, impressive hall. The crowd is standing with fists raised, shouting. They've dragged the moderator out by his arms and legs. Some guy has taken his place. Just a moment. We're getting word the new moderator is just some guy. Well, this is unusual. Here come the candidates. Oh, looks like we're getting ready to proceed. Here goes.
This question is for the red philodendron. How can you, a rich man beyond imagination, actually care about people who are poor, who work 9 jobs, take their children to daycare at 5 in the morning, and live week to week without health care, worrying about missing one paycheck or having to go to the doctor, not to mention buying food and gas and paying rent?
Well, I really, really care. I really do. I really, really, really do. I care so much. I deeply care. Yeah, I do. I really, really do.
You are a lying sack of shit, Mr. Philodendron. Mr. Blue Begonia, you seem not to care about this country having been attacked by the Israeli Mossad in conjunction with members of the previous administration. You laugh at those who do care, and then you dig that a big, elaborate hoax death of Osama bin Laden with all of your cabinet members in that one room acting like they were viewing a film of the action, and then later, get this, the Navy SEALs who were supposed to have been in that action, their plane, it crashed somewhere else and they died and they were not able to tell the truth. Oh, and before that, you said Osama bin Laden had been buried at sea, and all the national television stations and newspapers and radio shows just repeated what you said, and nobody was laughing. Remember that? Wow.
Is there a question in there somewhere?
Yeah. You talk about hope and change, but you seem to not give a crap about universal health care or killing people in other lands through drones and warfare. You seem to not care about spending most of our tax dollars on the military while schools and roads and people go without. Where is the hope, Mr. Blue Begonia? Where exactly is the fucking change?
Well, I believe if the good American people will elect me to a second term, that they'll see even more hope and yet more change.
But why should they do that, Mr. Blue Begonia? What have they seen from your first term that would make them want to give you a second term, let alone not want to put your ass in prison for war crimes of commission and omission, huh, dude? And Mr. Blue Begonia, if I may, a follow-up question about your first job out of college. Wasn't it with the CIA? Do you ever leave the CIA once you're in? Just saying, you know?
It seems there's a commotion in the really impressive big hall. The stage is filled with handlers for the Blue Begonia and the Red Philodendron, and they're being literally carried off the stage. Well, there they go. All that's left on the stage is a little moist potting soil. It's the new moderator is signing autographs. The TV crews are rolling up the wires and putting away the cameras. Well, that was indeed something. We hope you'll join us next week for the big vice presidential debate between the Boston Fern and the Creeping Fig.
And now we bring you the New American Dream masterpiece, classic Playhouse Theater, Something Something. Real voices with a message that you will not hear on the CBS Nightly News.
American comedian Bill Hicks. Go back to bed, America. Your government has figured out how it will all transpire. Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control again. Here's American Gladiators. Watch this. Shut up. Go back to bed, America. Here's American Gladiators. Here's 56 channels of it. Watch these retards bang their freaking skulls together and congratulate you on living in the land of freedom. Here you go, America. You're free to do as we tell you. You're free to do what we tell you.
This is from the Bill Hicks website. In 1993, a breakthrough seemed closer than ever. Rolling Stone had declared Bill Hot Stand-Up Comic of the Year. He began work on Counts of the Netherworld, a high-concept talk show for British TV. He had been nominated for Stand-Up of the Year by the American Comedy Awards for the third time. He wrote a column for the British humor magazine Scallywag, and he was asked to write for the political journal The Nation. Rock bands flocked to his banner. Radiohead, Rage Against the Machine, and Tool professed their admiration. He had been invited by the New York Public Library for Performing Arts to speak at Lincoln Center in June of 1994. Performance films, screenplays, books, and CD box sets were in various stages of discussion. Perhaps to take advantage of this synergy, Bill moved back to L.A.
Then in June, Bill learned he had cancer. Choosing to keep his illness a secret, he told his family, a few close friends, and went straight back to work. In August of 1993, Bill's brother Steve flew to L.A., and together they packed Bill's belongings into his Jeep and drove to Little Rock, Arkansas, where Bill moved into his parents' home. He's already recorded both Arizona Bay and Rant in E Minor, with ambitious plans to mix music that he'd recorded into the performance to complement the comedy themes. Throughout the year, Bill underwent chemotherapy on a weekly basis. The tour dates didn't let up, and his writing pace accelerated.
On February 7, 1994, Bill wrote his last words to the world.
I was born William Melvin Hicks on December 16, 1961, in Valdosta, Georgia. Ugh. Melvin Hicks from Georgia. Yee-haw! Already gotten off to life on the wrong foot. I was always awake, I guess you'd say, some part of me clamoring for new insights and new ways to make the world a better place. All of this came out years down the line in my multitude of creative interests. They're the tools I now bring to the party. Writing, acting, music, comedy. A deep love of literature and books. Thank God for all the artists who've helped me. I'd read these words and off I went, dreaming my own imaginative dreams, exercising them at will, eventually to form bands, comedy, more bands, movies, anything creative. On June 16, 1993, I was diagnosed with having liver cancer that had spread from the pancreas. One of life's weirdest and worst jokes imaginable. I'd been making such progress recently in my attitude, my career, and realizing my dreams that it just stood me on my head for a while. Why me? I would cry out. Why now? Well, I know there may never be any answers to those particular questions, but maybe in telling a little about myself, we can find some other answers to other questions. That might help our way down our particular paths towards realizing my dream of new hope and new happiness. Amen. I left in love, in laughter, and in truth. And wherever truth, love, and laughter abide, I'm there in spirit.
On Saturday, February 26, 1994, Bill Hicks died. He was 32. And now I'd like to welcome our first guest, Ava Bird. Like Chuck said, Ava was our first guest back in February of 2011, and she's been on the show several times. She's a Berkeley poet, and she always has something exciting going on and some great poems. Ava, are you there?
I'm here.
How
Thanks
you doing?
So much for having me on again. It's always my pleasure, and I always enjoy the show, whether I'm on it or not. I always like being on it. I always like listening to it.
Very cool. What do you have going on? Do you want to talk about your events, or you want to read a poem first? Do whatever you want.
Okay. I have a couple oldie but goodies. I've been working on a new poem. I really wanted to have the poem finished for the show, but I wasn't able to finish it because I have a busy travel schedule these days. But I'll have it done for the next time that I'm on, I'll have it done. It's called I Paid My Taxes and All I Got Was... dot, dot, dot. So that's coming up soon. In the meantime, I do have two poems that I thought always were good. And like I said, they're oldies but goodies. And I am actually in Los Angeles right now. I'm doing a small book tour. And I wanted to just mention, along with everything else that you guys are saying, to compliment that, you know, being in Los Angeles, I'm witness to the fairy tale nature of our lives here in America, and especially the charade of the presidential election that we're unfortunately having to witness jammed down our throats every day here. But it just gives rise to the fact that, you know, from the day we're born, pretty much being Americans, we're pretty much lied to from the day we were born, whether it's religion or being in the public school system or Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny. We are a nation of liars, unfortunately. And the two poems that I actually have two poems, but they're kind of one poem. and they are about, one is called He Buys, and the other one is called She Buys. And they're both about the lies that we swallow and believe and also tell ourselves, or lies that we're told and then we believe, and then we continue to perpetuate them onto our children, and, you know, it becomes kind of a vicious cycle. But so that was kind of a long introduction and a long breath, but how are you doing, Mike and Chuck?
We're doing great. That's about it. Go ahead with your poems.
Okay. So I'll read He Buys first, and then I'll go right into She Buys. Okay. He buys his slave master's lies. He buys the pornographic lies of cheap highs and fake breast size. He buys the lies of the sports heroes' high fives, the myth of the prize at the end of the maze, the empty haze of his points and jumps and fades in the sports page, his worship of a steroid on a rage with a ball and a super high wage. His mind is locked in a cage as he passes his days, suppressing his masculine rage with the worship of a mythical sage. His love of another man with a Hispanic name, Jesus Christos. His love of another man he worships like God, Muhammad. His love of another man as he runs around in funny clothes and throws a sword or a ball and he falls for the game. He's in pain and thinks it's gain, plowing down a lane, violent and insane. He buys the lies of these silly games, the boring statistics and useless facts to hack his brain into spam. And wham, bam, dude, did you see that overtime grand slam? Sports are a scam, he sold out to the man, video game joystick in hand. He sits on the couch like a lamb to the slaughter. He buys the corporation's lies of bonuses and funny-looking ties. His dreams are to rise above the punk cubicle guys to an office with a view from the phallic corporate high-rise. He prays for his company stock to rise. At his lunch break, he buys his sugar highs. McApple pies and a supersized fries, his brain dies. His stock multiplies, his board meeting divides. He buys another new necktie. His cell phone call calls for the demise and outsourcing of a company of a large size. He stops to buy another new tie, a distraction from his hair dye, a quick escape from the punk cubicle guys. He hides his corporate actions on the sly. He buys on a break another fancy tie covering the lies. He buys the pies on a chart that slices out the heart of a community. His job is disunity. He gets full impunity. He sees opportunity in another man's community. Drugs like Coca-Cola, aspartame, fluoride, and Ebola. Dead meat with E. coli. He buys a mad cow, a mad cowboy, with an erection for the military. He buys the military's lies as he buys new Nikes, rifles, while he prays to Mary. Buried in debt for a free education, war on the front lines is scary. He buys his slave master's lies. Okay, now this is She Buys. This is all the lies that women buy. Her doctor's a quack, drugs and kickbacks, head wax and pill packs. A punch that cracks like coke and choke on chemicals from Sprite and squirt and dirt, flirting with death on a plate, filled with chemicals deadly like meth. Depressed housewives tell lies to themselves about the hell of patriarchy, the malarkey of war, slaves, and hierarchy. She buys her slave master's lies. She buys SUVs and tries to pretend the highs of poison pills, Prozac and Zoloft are enough to fluff up her days of haze. The zombie maze, passionless lays, her blind acceptance of status quo's ways. The self-imposed slavery of high heels and skirts make up for self-worth. She buys the plastic surgeon's lies that she needs new thighs, a broken nose, and a boob job. New eyes to sob at the hatchet job. New knobs on her chest. Her doctor's a con job. She buys the lies and tries to smile through the plastic. A tragic facelift, a spiritual rift. She buys the highs to get to the lows of those she blows. On and off she goes, prescription poison woes. and no one even knows. In denial, she comes and goes, the throes, in a daze and a doze, off to sleep she goes, with clenched toes, and she doesn't even know. She wakes to buy hair dyes to cover her dress eyes, a tint to cover the hint of gray, of maturity, a gleaming ray. And then today, she buys sugar-filled pies, food in disguise, poison on the sly. She buys the highs, something in her dies. She buys the corporation's lies of hot buys, super deals, and prices so low. So she goes to the mall with a hard-on for a new doll, a ball, a new cell phone call. The halls in the mall are tall, the walls wide, so she can hide and ride the tide of buy, buy, buy. Shop till you drop, eat till you pop, she just won't stop. Rummaging through the slop, the needless props and crap, just let debt that won't let up with her buys. Winston-Salem's lies, the witch's needs, tobacco highs, ammonia, arsenic, formaldehyde snuck in on the sly. She lights the deadly stick with a flip of the bic. Again she's tricked. You've come a long way, baby. A scam for the addicted bitch. She's hitched. She's hitched and lynched by the dicks of a camel. Virginia Slim, a vagina slime. R.J. Reynolds' stock is high and right on time. He smirks and lurks in the racks, women's magazine stacks. This deadly stick works its way into the pages of good housekeeping sages. She's wise, but somehow buys these lies. The corporate ties, she buys her slave master's lies. She buys her prescription pills, her doctor fills at the spill of a hat. High on this and that, she gets fat, swings the bat, sweeps herself under the mat. She buys religion's lies, called the Mahoney and his Catholic baloney. He, the holder of the most real estate on earth, fails to offer faith, hope, love, and mirth upon women he murders for witches while sneaking hands in little boys' britches. These lynches for profit and property, a mockery of spirituality, housing pedophiles. She's a lamb to the slaughter turnstiles. She buys her slave master's lies.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to know you're out there telling the truth, and you always seem to be very active. Could you give us, in closing, could you give us some details of about upcoming events on your book tour?
Sure. I'd love to. Thanks for asking again. And again, thanks for having me on the show. It's always a pleasure. I have a reading tomorrow night in San Francisco. It's actually a little bit of a different take on things. It's called The Poetry of Yoga. And it's spiritual poetry that is got published in a book called The Poetry of Yoga. It's an anthology of yogi poets from around the world. And so we're having a book release party for that tomorrow night in San Francisco. It starts at 7 p.m. and it's at the Integral Yoga Institute in San Francisco. And you can always check my website, it's ompoem.com, and I try to update my shows and my readings and things. And working on a CD that I'll send to you when I have it finished. It's my poetry behind some music. So, you know, maybe you can use it for filler one day on your show on the New American Dream. Yeah, thanks again for letting me spout off my poetry and sharing some truth. And I always enjoy listening to you guys and appreciate the humor, too. And as you know, I try to mix that up in my poetry also.
It's really nice talking to you, Ava, and have a good night and good luck on your book tour.
Thanks a lot, and hopefully next time I'm on the show, I'll have my new poem ready, and, you know, we'll blast us all off.
Okay, we'll look forward to that. See ya.
Okay, have a great rest of the show, and talk to you guys real soon.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
And now, please sit back and relax. Put your feet up. Don't talk. Shut up now if you're talking. As we hear another episode of Fighting Father Jack Duffy, War Priest of West Omaha.
He set his clubs by the front door, hurried back to his room to get something he'd forgotten. When he got there, he had to go back to the front door to remember why he'd gone to his room. But now he remembered. Fighting Father Jack Duffy marched back to fetch his new golfing gloves. They were in the same sack with the red, white, and blue candles that he would use at the funeral. The Becker funeral was this afternoon. The Becker twins, David and Deborah, were killed together in Afghanistan, blown apart by the same bomb. Some say that funeral home people only hope that they got the right arms and legs on the right torsos. Heads weren't really too much of a problem, they said. Fighting Father Jack Duffy checked his watch again and then sat down for a quick bite in the kitchen. Mrs. Svoboda had set out his milk, noon pill, and his pickle and cheese sandwich and diet wafer cookie. Mrs. Svoboda, he recalled just now that he did not really know her first name after all these years. He'd come out to St. Ronald Parish from South Omaha with Father Jack, kind of like a head coach takes his assistants with him when he gets a new job. Oh, sure, there was talk. But there's always talk. He just felt comfortable with her, that's all. She knew him, knew his history, what he would eat, what he wouldn't, how he'd gotten his name from having told the guys in the seminary up in St. Paul that he used to box in South O, so he would be known as a regular guy. And then because when he got ordained, the bishop even said, Fighting Father Jack Duffy, when he put the holy oils on his head. A few years later, the Air Force asked him to come out to Offutt and bless the new chapel with the stained glass window depicting the airman running for his bomber with the mushroom cloud in the background and the words, "Send me, Lord!" Father Jack's now the senior priest, the pastor at St. Ronnie, since Bill Kropp retired. He gulped down the rest of his lunch and reached into the fridge for a little more milk. He set the glass into the sink, walked to his study. He stood over his desk looking down at the letter. He pulled it to his face with one hand, then held it with both hands. It was a letter from David Becker when he was a senior in high school, wondering what he should do, asking Father Jack if he thought he should join the military. "My sister is kind of wondering, too," the letter said. "We just thought you could tell us, you know. Thou shalt not kill, honor America, fighting for freedom. What are we supposed to think about all that? What would Jesus do, you know?" He set the letter back onto his desk, turned and headed for the front door, grabbing his golf clubs on the way out. He turned to holler something to Mrs. Svoboda upstairs, but remembered this was her day off. He left the front door open in case Father Martin did not have his key. In the sacristy, Father Jack placed the red, white, and blue stole around his neck and shoulders. He sat in his chair listening to the people filling the church, said hello to the servers when they arrived, went outside to smoke, but then thought better of it. "We're gathered here today." Fighting Father Jack Duffy stood at the head of the two caskets in the middle aisle, his hands raised. "To honor two of our own who died fighting for our freedom." With a nod, he was able to get the whole congregation to sit. "They fought and they died and sacrificed so that we may be able to worship together today in freedom in America." He spoke about the love of these young people for their church and their country. He mentioned the attacks of September 11, 2001, four times by the kind of a reporter in the back row. "We honor these two young warriors as we honor God and America. Now, let us pray." He again raised his hands and, like a circus magician, was able to induce everyone to stand. Father Jack turned and walked to the altar, accepted the water and wine from the servers as the organist began to play. "God bless America." Everyone sang. At the final hymn, Father Jack Duffy sat in the gold-lined chair at the top of the altar. He pulled back his robe to check his watch, then followed the caskets up the aisle. At the the cemetery, Father Jack said a prayer, stood aside as the military escort folded the two flags from the caskets and handed them to the overcome parents of Dave and Deborah Becker. After the invocation before the lunch at the church hall, Father Jack dashed into the sacristy, grabbed his clubs, threw them in the back seat, and backed out of the school blacktop parking lot. He rolled to an almost stop by the school dumpster to light his cigarette and roll both front windows down 3 inches, back up to 2 inches. Yeah, right there. Turned left from the alley, called his mother at the nursing home on his cell, visited with her as he took the long way to go past what he called his dad's cemetery. He saw the tent still up over the graves of David and Deborah Becker, not that far from his father's spot. Okay, gotta go, Mom. Love you. He grabbed his clubs and turned to smile and wave to the men waiting for him at the first tee. Join us next week for another episode of Fighting Father Jack Duffy, War Priest of West Omaha.
This portion of our program is being provided to you by the good folks at The Next Big Thing. New apps for your phone, more stuff for you to do while you are doing that boring driving thing. Well, folks, hold on to your hats because this new app is going to rock your world. It's the application that allows you to deal with the fact that UFOs, Bigfoot, and conspiracies are real. Download it today. Well, maybe tomorrow. We're working on it. We're getting dangerously close to the time when everyone will know that Bigfoot exists. We're not sure if you're ready for that, and that's why we're working overtime on new apps for you. We kind of like being one of the ones in the know, knowing about something so magical that others don't yet realize, but soon that will not be possible.
The folks at The Next Big Thing ask you to be careful what you hope for, huh? What happens the day Barack Obama and George W. Bush and his father walked out of a golf course in handcuffs charged with prior knowledge, hiding information about a felony, the attacks of 9/11? A thoughtful U.S. Marshal puts his hand on George Sr.'s head as so he doesn't bump it on the door. We get the final public sneer, that career criminal. It appears on the front page of the New York Post and Time Magazine and Rolling Stone. What happens when the talk about UFOs and Bigfoot and the Wellstone murder are about details, where and when and how, instead of a rolling of the eyes? What happens when we have actual names in court cases and confessions and Newsweek and Wall Street Journal and New York Times front page stories about the trial of some still living principals in the JFK and RFK and Martin Luther King murders? Our whole world will be rocked. And somebody will need to make an app for that in a darn big hurry. But, you know, thanks to the folks, it's the next big thing. It's already in the works, guys. Things will be different. Our whole perception of life and what we should be doing in life will be changed forever. That might be scary, but it's where we need to go. Down the rabbit hole, folks. Step right up. Don't be shy. Okay, now, careful. One at a time. No pushing. Everybody will get their turn. Easy now. Careful. There you go. We're the next big thing. We bring your world to your vehicle, your doorstep, and right on up to your mind. And now, on a bit more serious note, our second guest, John Grant, is a science fiction and science fact writer. And we welcome you, John, to the New American Dream Radio Show.
Hi there, Chuck. Hi there, Mike.
We're very glad that you could join us tonight. Sorry we took so long to get to you. I know we're running a little late. It's a good thing we don't have an actual end time, so we get to have the full-length interview.
I see.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, how you got to this point, that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah, that's always the kind of embarrassing bit, isn't it? I was born in the north of Scotland and lived for, what, my first 50 years in Britain, and mainly in England, and then about a dozen or more years ago, made the foolish mistake of falling in love with an American, so I moved across to this country. But I started off in publishing, and in about 1980, I turned to writing, and since then I've written about 60 or 70 books, of which about a third of them are fiction, and the other two-thirds are non-fiction. You know, why I'm here tonight is because a number of the non-fiction ones have been in a kind of curious field related to the sciences. It started off with a book called Discarded Science, where I was looking at, theories and ideas of science that had fallen by the wayside or which had never been taken seriously to begin with. And I then wrote a book to follow it up about corrupted science, which I was particularly concerned about because, of course, at the time the Bush administration was severely corrupting government science by putting pressure on scientists to be quiet about global warming, just for a start. I then wrote a book called Bogus Science, and more recently I've written another one called Denying Science, which came out last fall. So that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Well, I think it's really good that you are bringing to light what is essentially a conspiracy by those in power to suppress science, to twist results to their own ends. Of course, that's what they do with every sort of truth. It's not just science that they do that with. But
the Bush administration did corrupt science really quite seriously. The Obama administration is far less guilty of corrupting science, although it does tend to kind of damp down some of the science that it doesn't like.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an example?
Yeah. One of the big problems that we have in this country is that, in the factory farms, animals are being fed, obscenely huge quantities of antibiotics, because it helps keep them in disgusting conditions. You know, it helps keep them healthy-ish in disgusting conditions, and also for some reason fattens them up quicker. And the consequence of this huge feeding of antibiotics into the food chain is essentially that our factory farms have got have become breeding grounds for superbugs that are resistant to the whole spectrum of antibiotics, and those superbugs inevitably get into the human population, with the result that you have people starting to get nasty diseases which antibiotics are totally powerless to deal with. And towards the end of last year, this came up for discussion with the Obama administration, who had the opportunity to do something and start introducing sensible controls on this particular antibiotic use. And instead of doing anything about it, they just kind of kicked the can further down the road. So it'll be another few years before the problem is sensibly tackled. Well, those extra few years in this kind of problem could very well be fatal, because who knows how many of our antibiotics will be rendered ineffective by the time those few years are up.
Yeah, they're certainly a lot less effective than they were when we were growing up, for example. And I owe my life to antibiotics when I was a kid. If I got the same diseases today, I don't know if I would survive, if they'd be effective. There's so much of these resistant strains. Anyway, I think you had something to say about global warming, or perhaps you were going to read a little lecture that you do? Or?
Well, in fact, I was planning to you know, I was asked to you know, sort of read a little bit out of the book, which I'll gladly do. It's not specifically
okay, well,
about
that'd
be global
good.
Warming. But,
okay, you, great.
If you will bear with me, I'll read a few pages of the introduction. You'll have to stop me when I run out of time, because, of course, I won't know that I've done so.
Okay, we'll do that.
You know, sort of mad cries of, oh, for God's sake, stop, you know, will be required.
I'll try to be a bit gentler than that.
Anyway, here's from the start of the book. Denial of science is everywhere around us, not just in bars and offices and pulpits, but in the lips of our broadcasters and legislators, our movers and shakers. There's denial that AIDS and HIV are connected, and that traditional remedies can't cure AIDS. There's denial of the science showing vaccines don't cause autism. A century and a half after publication of Darwin's Origin of Species, there's still denial that we came to be what we are through natural selection. And 180 years or so after publication of Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology, demonstrating beyond all possible doubt that the Earth is ancient, there are plenty who'll tell you it's only a few thousand years old, and that our ancestors romped with dinosaurs, and that the Sun and all the rest of the universe go round the Earth. There are those who argue that putting a zygote to use to offer potential cures to the currently uncurable in stem cell therapy is killing a child, whereas flushing that same zygote down the toilet isn't. There are those who deny the benefits of genetically modified foodstuffs in a world of soaring human population, and there's another denial story in itself. And those who deny the concerns that in some instances more research is needed before letting the genetically modified organisms into the wild. The dangerously deleterious environmental impacts of intensive farming are so widely denied that in the average US supermarket there's likely to be no non-factory meat, poultry and fish on offer at all. And there are still plenty of people around who deny that smoking causes illness and death. There are those who, because it offends their ideology or simply because they've been deluded by demagogues and industry shills, deny the reality of global warming, even though the evidence is becoming drastically harder to ignore with every passing year. And this is hardly to start the list of the science denials that are currently corrupting our culture and poisoning our public discourse, stifling our ability to make the right decisions for society's benefit and the well-being of our children and grandchildren. The denial of science is a topic of enormous breadth and depth. When I first decided to write this book, I thought I'd be able to cover every aspect of it, if not exhaustively, then at least in enough detail to give a fairly comprehensive idea of what was going on. It soon became clear to me that this was impossible. If I didn't want to produce a book the size of the Encyclopedia Britannica, I was going to have to tone down my aspirations a trifle, which meant deciding to give some aspects of denialism scant treatment to allow space for others that seemed more important. How could the richest country on the planet, home to some of the world's finest university and libraries, have reached the sorry state where denialism of science, of objective reality, is rampant? In the weeks after a deranged gunman, Jared Lochner, shot Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and 18 others, rightists in the U.S. claimed the killer was a leftist, while leftists claimed that the killer was a rightist. In an essay on this situation, the educator Steve Striffler put his finger on one of the primary reasons that there's so much anti-scientific nonsense permeating U.S. culture. Like Lochner, said Striffler, a significant portion of young people are, for very good reasons, profoundly anti-establishment, distrustful of anything they hear from the government or mainstream media. In a world where fragments of information come from so many sources, it often leads them to the odd place where any explanation of the world is as good as any other, where there's no conceptual rudder for judging one theory or idea against another. End of quote. In other words, we have a bad case of GIGO, of garbage in, garbage out. if you put enough garbage into people's minds, sooner or later too many people will believe too much of it, even if the bits they believe are mutually incompatible. Rather than being taught how to think analytically or constructively, people are being taught to stop thinking, all the while believing that their disagreement with the views of experts is really a case of thinking for themselves.
This I think we better stop there, John.
Oh, right.
That was a great excerpt, and hopefully it'll whet people's appetite, and they'll want to find your book. So I think you'd better tell them where to get it.
Oh, well, the book can be, I don't know, it can be bought anywhere that good books are sold. It's publicly available. It's obviously it's on, you know, sort of Amazon, Barnes and Noble, etc., as well as in bricks and mortar bookshops, or it can be purchased directly from the publisher, Prometheus Books. It's called Denying Science, and my name is John Grant. It's actually quite an exciting time at the moment, because the earlier three books that I mentioned, Discarded Science, Corrupted Science, and Bogus Science, have just this week come out in e-book format. They were originally hardbacks. And, so I'm quite excited about having to cope with the three of those now being in this new format. I'm hoping the publisher does a good job of it. But,
I haven't
actually yet seen the e-books myself. They haven't sent me copies.
Will they be, Kindle and Nook and all the usual...
All the usual formats, yeah. They're already available there, and in the iBook store for Apple.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us. I hope that maybe 2 or 3 months down the road we might do it again, and
be fun.
Either continue this topic or another one.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Good
take
night.
Care now. Bye.
Do we believe what we believe because we have studied, held them in our hands, rolled them around and decided? Or was it because we heard it on the TV from some person being paid to deliver the message?
It's been a long road. From a stolen election to a government-planned attack on September 11, 2001, to two invasions based on lies, based on power, on money, to a murdered senator, the one standing in their way would not be moved. We didn't want it to come. We marched, we emailed, we sang, we wrote, we got arrested. But it came anyway, and it's still here. The new American dream is a yellow ribbon free zone. We do not support the troops. The troops are not defending our freedom. They are thugs for the empire. Hoorah. We heard all about putting a boot up their ass from Toby Keith. He's a brave man to encourage other men to kill women, men, and children for no reason. Real patriots were the Dixie Chicks. We all know that now. Protesters protect our freedom. Think Cynthia McKinney and Cindy Sheehan, not George Bush and John McCain. A hero does not drop bombs on people who are trying to live their lives. Come on, teachers, priests, ministers, coaches, parents, please start telling the truth. We can handle the truth. In fact, without the truth, we cannot live. We will die. Slowly, then all at once. We will collapse, and that will be that. It will be over. A dusty pile of rubble and ho-hos and lies. We need a new dream, something real, solid to believe in. Truth in our history books. Bread on the table of the poor. We have many heroes from which to draw inspiration, people who gave and are giving their lives to the truth. Patriots, if you will, saints, hard workers, whatever you want to call it, they're there. They've always been there, even if we don't see them, even if they're not famous. They don't give a damn about that. They're driven by something inside of them. And we can draw hope from the absolute fact that that same thing is also inside of us. People like Franz Jagerstatter, Sophie Scholl, Philip Berrigan, Daniel Berrigan, Dorothy Day, Frank Cordero, Deborah Sweet, Carl Kabat, Helen Woodson, the Plowshares Movement, the Nuclear Resistor, Eileen Fleming, Sam Smith, Jim Fetzer, Kevin Barrett. This message brought to you by the good folks at World News Trust, the Spiritual UN, author James Boomey, the former Rock Creek Free Press, and those individuals who've contributed over the past 20 months so we can bring you the New American Dream Radio Show. If you'd like to become an advertiser or a supporter, please contact me, Chuck Gregory, at CWG Services, cwgservices.com. If you just want to be anonymous, there's a donation button on our site, theshow.newamericandream.info. Thanks also go out to the many guests who have taken the time to visit with us over these months, and most especially to all of you. Thank you for listening.
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. Democratic candidate Joe Coffey went to speak in a big school auditorium on a Saturday to a group of Democrats. Joe got up and saw himself in slow motion walking up the steps to the crowd's applause. He wished for a railing, reached the shiny wood stage, and headed for the podium's safe haven. His shoes clicked on the wood stage floor. Coffey felt the presence of the people at the long folding table on his left and a sea of upturned white faces on his right. He shook the MC's hand and moved toward the blonde wood podium. Joe placed his papers, adjusted the mic, and looked up to his right where Jane would be, but saw only dark shadows under the balcony overhang area. "Well, hello," he tapped the mic. "Is this on?" He smiled. My wife and I, Jane, she's back over there somewhere." Jane must have stood and waved because some of the others applauded and waved to her. "Well, I remember driving through Yankton, South Dakota," Joe continued. "It was a time of great personal struggle and uncertainty. I think we were on our way to the Black Hills. I don't think we ever got there." Joe adjusted the microphone and grabbed the sides of the podium as he had seen the governor do in the previous speech. "We stopped at a motel and watched the Tiananmen Square crisis unfold on the television. It was also a time of the destruction of the Berlin Wall, the release of Mandela, and later the election of Clinton." He began to make eye contact as he read his speech. "Along with others, I hoped for the better, for a peace dividend in the United States that would give hope to the poor. It never came. Those in places of power who make money from military procurement could breathe a sigh of relief that it was deemed prudent that the United States military remain unnaturally strong. My sister in Columbus, with 8 children to raise on her own, could find a way to get by," our leader said. "The military contractors would not have to. We have schools in Mount Liberty, Mount Carl, and Mount Dorothy, and Mount Jennifer, all around the district that need fixing. We have made staff cuts at our school. Many school boards are making the same sorts of heart-wrenching decisions for lack of money." Joe looked up, surprised that people were listening. "And yet we continue to build state and federal prisons at a rapid rate. The United States incarcerates a higher percentage of its population than any nation on earth. State governments invariably spend more on prisons and jails than on colleges and universities." Joe looked up and over and saw that Jane was standing in front of her seat with one arm wrapped around the post in front of her, watching with rapt attention.
"When I went to my first newspaper interview in Mount Brittany, the reporter said my ideas were out there. At least he knew that's what his readers would think. I know what he meant. But nothing great is accomplished without ideals, without dreams, without putting forth proposals that at first seem really out there. And it's not failure but a low aim that is the crime. It's a mistake to regard idealism as a sentimental weakness." Joe put a touch of bass to his voice. He heard his voice going out. He knew where he was, but willed himself not to think about it. Those quotes come from the early Wilson era. When providing for the poor while seeking to limit the reach of the rich and powerful were talked about openly. Today, liberal is a swear word. Joe looked at his audience and paused. He shifted his feet, then put pressure on his hands on the sides of the podium. A portion of his brain imagining the podium pitching forward into the crowd. The real obscenity is the way political parties and politicians will stick their fingers into the air to check the wind and then sprint in that direction. I am a Democrat because John Kennedy was a Democrat. My mother and father were Catholics and Democrats. Actually, my dad was a Catholic and Democrat because my mom was. That's the way it works many times. Party affiliation passed across the breakfast table. On the first day ever of school, my kindergarten teacher, Miss Cole, wrote in gigantic yellow flaky letters on the blackboard, the size of that neon signboard on Times Square, President John F. Kennedy. Then we prayed for Kennedy in our third grade classroom with Sister Ellen on the day he was shot. Before that day, we thought the world was nice. That presidents were perfect, that people in leadership had our best interests in mind. Since that time, we found out different, but the ideal remains. The governor, seated below, leaned to whisper something to the other candidate, Joe's opponent, who in turn tilted right to whisper to his wife, who laughed out loud and looked up at Joe Coffey. I did not choose to run because I suddenly felt qualified. I just realized that I wished politicians, newspaper reporters, and news anchors talked about issues the way I wanted them to be talked about, as if they thought we had a brain in our head. Jane cheered with half a dozen others in the audience. She'd not seen Joe's speech because she demanded he write it himself. Nobody comes around and asks you if you want to bomb Iraq or Kosovo or Afghanistan, whether you want 30 new federal prisons built this year. Nobody asks you if you want your son forced to sign up for military induction. Nobody asks you. So sometimes, you just have to tell them how you feel.
The state Democratic Party chairman leaned across the table to the county Democratic Party chair. Where did you get this fool, he asked. The county chair shrugged his shoulders. Another reporter asked me what I thought about health care and Social Security. I said I did not know. She said I had to know. I said I did not. Social Security, Medicare, minimum wage, those are all important issues. The environment, immigration, all very important. There are 30 other important issues we could name. But until we come to grips with our idolatry of the military, the rest is secondary. Joe watched as the state chairman loudly pushed his chair back to stand and walked down the steps, up the aisle, and out the door. Joe began his next sentence. Reporters asked me why I am running. Well, do you remember way, way back, just after the Columbine tragedy? President Clinton asked our young people to find nonviolent ways to solve their problems. Well, that was while President Clinton and the rest of us adults were bombing Yugoslavia every morning, afternoon, and night. Our children are watching us every step we take, and they are down there low with a great perspective to be able to really see which direction we go. Joe began to speak slower, responding to a note he had scribbled in the margin. Go slow, stupid.
As he read, a voice, perhaps his own, told him he could do this. This administration is dominated and directed by wealth and for the accumulation of wealth. I believe that democracy has so far disappeared in the United States that no two evils exist. There's but one evil party with two names, and it will be elected despite all I can do or say. That was W.E.B. Du Bois, co-founder of the NAACP, in 1956, saying why he would not vote. Many now take that option. We need to have variety, choice, and fire for democracy to work. The governor excused himself, waited for his wife to stand, then waved to the crowd as they walked away. The governor shook hands as he made his way up the middle aisle. I think it is important and healthy to have at least one nobody in this race, and I claim that distinction. Because going around to get signatures, you can see the disgust on some people's faces the moment you say Democrat or Congress or running for office. They are frustrated with the process because it should be more open. If I can be up here, you can be up here too. We should be excited about the process, not resigned to its ultimate uselessness. The governor passed the maintenance man standing in the doorway, deciding to make the governor walk around him. A few delegates made their way to the side aisles to catch the governor with a request before they departed. Two reporters with camera bags slung over their shoulders who'd been leaning against the far wall, taking notes as Joe spoke, flapped their notebooks closed and hurried to get a last photo and quote from the governor. It is true that you almost have to be a contract lawyer to figure out the difference between the Democrat and Republican parties. It shouldn't be that way. Politicians want to say nice things, the right things, in order to get elected. Then when we get in, we'll really shake things up, we whisper. Well, you can see what Clinton did. He bailed out. Anybody with eyes or a heart can see what Obama did.
Someone groaned in the mid-left section of the crowd. Joe noticed movement around him, a general impatience for his speech to be over. If there was a reason to impeach President Clinton, it was not sex under an antique desk. It was the bombing of Iraq, the continued bombing of Iraq, and the continued sanctions against Iraq, costing millions of lives, many of them children. It was the welfare reform bill that underlined our disdain for the poor. It was the 1996 crime bill that allocated $8 billion for new prisons. It was the attack and slaughter of the Branch Davidians at Waco. It was the murder of Randy Weaver's wife and son. It was the bombing of Afghanistan and Sudan in the summer of 1998. It was his continued support for the drug war and the use of the death penalty. A few people applauded. Others rustled paper. And can we agree that the crimes and omissions of the Obama administration are too obvious to have to run down point by point? Assorted coughs caused Joe to look up. Jane's loud clapping echoed. Joe stood on one leg and turned over his last page to find the rest of his speech. With all due respect, the standard Democratic platform is as boring as watching paint dry and just as useful. As the song goes, you have to sing like you don't need the money. Joe looked up, expecting applause or a chuckle. Our children expect, they just assume that this is a good world. Joe tried to speak slowly and louder. We owe it to them and to the child within ourselves not to give up on that ideal too soon. Thank you.
Joe turned right to shake the MC's hand, but the committee man had sneaked in around the left and was already speaking into the microphone to organize lunch break. Some people clapped for Joe. Others turned to look at the clock on the balcony. Others leaned over seats and aisles to make lunch plans. A clipboard banged against his seat. Joe heard Jane clapping as he searched between the sweat drops in his eyes for the steps to descend the stage. He thought of Rocky, blinded in the middle of the ring, screaming, "Adrian! Adrian!" And he hurried, leaning up the aisle toward Jane, holding their coats and papers. "I think we'd better get out of here," she said, handing Joe his coat. Joe followed Jane through the auditorium doors, trying to find his sleeves with his arms. They pushed into the hall, now brimming with people. Jane and Joe hugged the shiny brown bricks of the near wall. Jane helped Joe with his coat. He thought people stared at them. "Damn this thick, downy, fluffy shit." "Let's go," she said. "The door's right here. The car's right there." "Why so fast?" said Joe. He looked around, counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 9. 9 people staring at them. "It's a pretty good crowd. Somebody might want to talk. Visit, discuss issues, policy," he said to Jane. "I don't know," she said. "I don't think so. I'm not feeling good." She grabbed his arm, pulled him along by the sleeve to follow her. Joe followed, looking over his shoulder at his admirers as he caught the handoff of the glass door from Jane. He picked up the pace as they hit the sidewalk. Joe pranced over the wet spots with his head down. Must have rained a little, he thought. He jumped into the driver's side of the van and hit the button to unlock Joe's side. He opened it slowly and watched a line of men and women fall out the middle school double doors. "Get in," Jane commanded. She hit the button locking all the car doors as Joe reached for his seatbelt. Jane pulled down the reverse and looked out the back window while Joe watched out the front. The group had grown to a dozen, a loose circle standing in silence. All heads turned to watch Jane curl into the street. Joe waved as they left. The eyes of the crowd followed like a trick portrait. The state chairman and county chair held styrofoam cups and stood in their shirt sleeves. They looked at each other as Joe waved. Jane pulled to the stop sign. She slowed, looked one way, then gunned into the intersection. "Hey," Joe shouted, grabbing his door handle. "They wanted to kill you," she yelled over the sound of the radio. "What? Yeah? Well, that's a reason to leave," he said. Just because some people didn't like what I said, I think some of them did like it. Jane accelerated through the yellow on Main Street. Joe clutched his door and looked both ways. She swerved into Casey's and found an empty stall. In one motion, she switched off the engine and turned to Joe. "They wanted to kill you," she said. He waited. They stared at each other. "I heard them. That one guy and the governor standing by me. They didn't know who I was, obviously. I was leaning against that pole facing away. They didn't think I could hear." "They were angry?" Joe felt hurt. "At me? About what?" "Well," he began to page through his speech on his left. "Well, okay, but that's who I am. They understand. They're politicians. They know how things are, right?" "They understand that you are a threat," said Jane. "You're not their boy. This is serious business to them." What did they say?" asked Joe. "They said kill?" "Well, no. Maybe not." Jane cast a glance out the back window. "No. Not like that." "So how do you know?" pleaded Joe. Jane straightened in her seat. "I guess maybe I don't." She leaned forward to start the van, then twisted her neck to see to back up.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO voting machine home repair shop owners are about average.
And that's the end of this episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. Once again, we thank you for listening. We love to do this show for you. Thanks again to World News Trust and the Spiritual UN and James Boomey, June 2508, his book. And thank you, Mike, and good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Pamela Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.